Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a really good Monday. Our very fine Monday show continues with Carlo Broussard this hour. We're going to talk about whether the Jesus story is fact or fiction. Carlo is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a bunch of books, including Purgatory is for Real, Good News About the Afterlife for Those Who Aren't Perfect Yet. Hello, Carlo Broussard.
Hey, Cy.
Thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me, brother.
Do you have any feelings about dolphins, pro-dolphin, anti-dolphin?
I think they're beautiful creatures, and they're really cool.
See, that Trent Horn came out as anti-dolphin the last hour. I don't know what Trent is doing.
I have no idea.
All right, the Jesus story. Fact or fiction? It seems to me that the primary reason or way that we lose young people from Christianity is they go, it's a myth, you know, and it's a good myth, and it's one, you know, I like Christian values.
Right.
I just don't believe the story. I mean, I don't believe that Jesus is really God, you know, that kind of thing. Would you agree with that?
Would I agree with your assessment?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah.
There is a tendency in pop culture to divorce Christianity from the person of Jesus Christ, viewing Christianity as maybe just a way of living, a philosophy of life, sort of the Christian ethic, you know, the ethos and how we ought to interact and behave.
Right.
But separating it from the person of Jesus Christ. And the assumption being that you can sort of have Christianity without Jesus.
Right.
But classic Christianity says no to that. Our belief, our religion is rooted in the historical person of Jesus Christ. And so the historicity of Jesus, not only his existence, that he was a historical guy that lived on this earth, but the Jesus story itself is crucial and absolutely essential for us as Christians, especially for convincing and persuading people within the culture. So within the Christian community, you have oral tradition, right? And so those within the community, we could appeal to simply that tradition that has been transmitted within the living experience of being a Christian. And we say, yeah, we know about Jesus. We know the Jesus story based upon that oral tradition. But that's not something that non-believers are privy to, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
The historical credibility of the Jesus story as found in the New Testament, and in particular the Gospels, is absolutely essential for promoting the Christian message and promoting Jesus Christ. Because if one does not perceive the Jesus story to be credible and historically reliable, then they're not going to come to believe in Christ. They're going to perceive the Jesus story as mere fiction. Even if they're willing to concede and acknowledge that maybe Jesus was a historical person, which we have good, solid historical evidence from. We have extra-biblical sources such as Tacitus, Roman historian Tacitus in his annals, and you also have Josephus affirming the reality of Jesus. And so even if someone's willing to concede that, they still may very well be skeptical with regard to the Jesus story itself.
Yeah.
And so it's important that we're able to defend the reliability of the Jesus story against two possible oppositions. So some might say that the Christian authors were dishonest, right? So the dishonest view, so that we don't know about the Jesus story is fiction insofar as these authors were intentionally inventing things about Jesus, what he said and what he did. So that would be what you might label the dishonest view of the fictional story of Jesus.
They made it up.
But then there's also another view, which is the honest but mistaken view.
Okay.
That would say, yeah, the Jesus story is fictional in the sense that these authors, although were good-willed and believing, you know, the stuff that they received, the traditions about the Jesus story that they received and inherited were mixed with legendary developments. And so we can't really trust their accounts of the Jesus story because of all this intermingling of legendary developments, which would sort of be the wall that blocks us from getting back to the real historical Jesus. So, for example, the Jesus Seminar in 1991, after a six-year study, came to the conclusion that only 20% of Jesus' sayings in the Gospels were authentic, implying that 80% were inauthentic, right?
Wow.
And so, and then, of course, you have other skeptics who go around talking about how the Gospels are just a highly dubious source, right? I remember the late Christopher Hitchens said that. The late American journalist H.L. Mencken referred to the New Testament as a helter-skelter accumulation of more or less discordant documents, right? So you have these two views. You know, the Jesus story is fictional, whether it's the dishonest view, it's fictional because they invented the sayings, or this honest but mistaken view, it's fictional in the sense that it's so intermingled with legendary developments, we couldn't possibly know what Jesus actually said and did. And so these are the two views that we could possibly respond to in our conversation today.
And we're familiar with the person who, we post something on, probably right now as this is, on Facebook or YouTube or something, saying, it's all a myth. Why do you bother with this? You know, why do you listen to these guys? They're just spreading myths and that kind of thing. And then there are people who will respond saying, with a kind of generalized religious, I think that they too think it's a myth. But it's a good myth, and you shouldn't mess with it. So we have to be clear that we're not taking that position. We're taking the position, no, this is actual historical fact. When you read the Gospels, what you're reading is history.
That is correct. And that we have good, reasonable grounds through historiographical research to come to the conclusion that what the New Testament authors are giving us in their records of Jesus's life is reliable.
Yeah.
We can establish a general trustworthiness of the Gospels in general, but then there are also ways in which scholars and historians are able to zero in and focus in, right, on specific and particular sayings of Jesus or events of Jesus, and using certain criteria in order to discern and decipher if this is historically reliable, specifically, that saying, that event.
Right.
So even if one is not willing to approach the Gospels generally with a sense of trust, although I think we have good reason to do so, you still could and are able to show the historicity of certain teachings of Jesus, certain events in Jesus's life as recorded in the Gospels. When collectively taken together, you still can make a good, reasonable account for Jesus Christ being God and rising from the dead, etc. So there are multiple ways in which you can ground the historical reliability of the Jesus story as found in the Gospels, and even parts of the Jesus story being found in the writings of St. Paul himself, because St. Paul does talk about certain things about Jesus, with some of the teachings that he handed over and some biographical details as well.
But all of this assumes that it assumes that the texts that we have are the actual texts. That, do you see what I'm saying? That
there's not. We are making this assumption here.
So, because I think what a lot of people would say to you is, all right, first of all, they didn't, I'm going to say what I've heard people say, and you tell me what's correct and what's incorrect about that. One, they'll go, hundreds of years pass between the life of Jesus and the time people started writing this stuff down. And how do you know that the things that you have now are even what was written down, because there's so much time has passed? So what do you make of those objections?
Yeah, so with regard to the latter, the reliability of the manuscripts does come into play. That's sort of the presupposition. That's the starting point before we even ask or answer the question, were the apostles in a position to reliably record for us the life and teachings of Jesus?
Okay.
So with regard to the manuscript reliability, that question is very solid, right? The answer to that question is very solid for the Christian position. So, for example,
That's actually a strong point of ours.
It's a strong point of ours, because when we look at just the the time gap between the original autographs and the manuscripts that we have. I mean, we have entire books of the New Testament manuscripts dating to AD 200, right?
Yeah.
And so if these autographs, as we're going to talk about in our conversation, were written, let's say, about AD 60, right?
Yeah.
So you're looking at 140 time gap. Now, to us, that might seem like a lot. But when you compare that with other ancient secular documents, so for example, Pliny the Younger, he was a lawyer and magistrate of ancient Rome from 61 to 112, and his letters are an invaluable source,
yeah.
Right? Historical source of the time period. And so the earliest copy of letter of copies that we have, it dates to the 800s.
Yeah.
That's right. 687 right. plus years.
Right.
Time gap between the autograph of Pliny the Younger and the copies
yes.
that we have. So that's just one example among many. It just the time gap just gets larger and larger and larger
sure.
when we look at other ancient documents. And when you compare that to the Christian documents, which are only 140, 150 years, these manuscripts, that is, removed from the original autographs, you're able to conclude that wow, the manuscript reliability is pretty sound.
Really? Yeah.
And then when you take into consideration the number of the copies of the Greek manuscripts that we have, numbers to right around 5,600 copies of the Greek manuscripts. And that's not including the translations in Latin, Syriac, Coptic, Aramaic, right? When you take all of that, you got a total of 20,000 copies when you look at all the different translations
that's
of the manuscripts.
A ridiculous plenitude. I mean,
and there's the manuscript tradition that comes in second place to the Christian tradition is Homer's Iliad. That's about 643 copies of manuscripts that we
wow,
have.
When you think about that.
That's right. So given the plethora of copies that we have allows for historians to come to the conclusion with a high degree of certainty that what we have in the manuscript tradition is what the original autographs were.
And so if you apply the same standard to the Gospels, for example, that you apply to the Iliad or Pliny or Caesar's commentaries or any of the other ancient books.
That is correct.
The Gospels actually win. They don't lose.
That is correct. You're going to come to the conclusion that, well, yeah, we can trust the manuscript tradition of the Christian documents.
Okay. So then we'll come back and we'll talk about the apostles themselves and whether they were in a position to reliably relate the story and write it down. We've got to take
correct.
A quick break.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Carlo. We'll be right back with more with Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
We should pray because prayer is conversation with God, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship. We need that relationship with God. We should pray and talk with God about what's on our hearts, what's on our minds, what's active in our lives, the joys we have. We should share all of these with God. Prayer is conversation, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship. All of our other relationships depend on this one.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carlo Broussard is here with us. Carlo is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, a very fine speaker and the author of a whole bunch of books, including Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. Well, one of the obstacles to embracing the gospel is the sense that it's just not accurate. So the story, you're here to say the story is true and reliable, and we have good reason to say that.
Indeed, I am.
Okay, so what about, let's go with the dishonest theory then. The idea that, okay, Carlo, what you said before we went to the break was the manuscript evidence is so much stronger for Christianity than for the Gospels, for example, than any other ancient books. But that doesn't tell me that the people who wrote the books were being honest. We're telling the truth.
Right.
Okay. So what do we make of the idea that the view that there's dishonesty at play here?
Well, there's several responses that we could give to that. Number one, the gospel writers had nothing to gain but everything to lose in promoting the Jesus story. The only thing they had to gain was death, right? And so that death is their only gain, right? So having only death to gain, and I mean, they're losing their life, their livelihood, their status in promoting the Jesus story, which includes the fact that he is Lord, that he is risen from the dead, gives us good reason to think they're not just making this stuff up willy-nilly and fabricating it. But we can go even further. Si, there are many embarrassing details. Scholars point out the fact that the gospel writers include in their stories of Jesus, in their narration, embarrassing details. This is one of the criteria. This is a criterion among many that historians look to in order to discern whether something is historic or not, whether something is sincere or legitimate. So, for example, we have Mark recording Peter's denial, and tradition tells us that Mark was the disciple of Peter and actually probably dictating what Peter was telling him in writing that gospel. And so Mark is actually including, coming from Peter, including Peter's denial. So if Mark were making this stuff up, why would he include such an embarrassing detail?
Yeah.
It doesn't, you would want to whitewash the tombs, right?
Yeah, right.
If you were fabricating the stories. In Matthew chapter 20, verse 24, we're told that the 10 were indignant at the two brothers, right? When they're talking when they're talking about who's going to sit at the right hand of Jesus and this and that. And the 10 were indignant, right? What'd they do with talking about that? That's an embarrassing detail. If you're making this stuff up, you're not going to want to give a portrait of the disciples as being, you know, bickering with each other. You also have embarrassing sayings of Jesus. So, for example, Mark records in Mark 6 that Jesus couldn't do a mighty work there, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't believe. So if you're making this stuff up, you're not going to be giving your audience the opportunity to begin thinking, well, Jesus isn't powerful enough to perform a miracle.
Right.
But the detail is there. Mm-hmm. And so that suggests authenticity. That suggests sincerity. Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone, Jesus says, according to Mark 10:18.
Right.
Why would he put that in there? To give his audience the possibility to even think that Jesus is not good?
Yeah, right.
So that doesn't fit with some sort of inventive theory. Jesus forbids divorce, which in their day included freedom to remarry. And remember the response, well, Jesus, if that's the case, why would we even get married?
Yeah.
Right. That's a hard saying. So if you're making this stuff up, you're going to want to sugarcoat some stuff make it easy, go down easy. You're not going to put the hard stuff in there. John records Jesus saying, eat my flesh, drink my blood. My goodness. You don't want to put that if you're making these things up, especially given the sensibilities of the first century Jewish people. And then finally, another embarrassing saying is Mark 13:32, when Mark records how Jesus says, you know, no one knows the day or the hour of the final judgment, nor does the Son know this. Now, in our tradition, we have ways in which we can read that and understand that, in which it doesn't take away from the divinity of Jesus, but just putting it in there suggests that, these gospel writers were sincere in just simply recording what they have been received in the tradition from the teachings of Jesus rather than fabricating this stuff up. Because if you're making it up, you're not going to give your audience the opportunity to begin thinking that, well, if Jesus doesn't know the day and the hour, well, maybe he's not God. Maybe he's not the Messiah.
Right.
And you don't want to give them that opportunity. So these are some examples of some embarrassing details that the gospel writers include, and that those embarrassing details are there indicates that they were not making this stuff up. They were sincere in recording what they had received and believing this to be a part of the real Jesus story.
Yeah, yeah. There's just something about the Gospels too it's either embarrassing or it's like that's just not something you'd put in there if it wasn't true. And I think it was Yves Lenoir who said he first realized that the Gospel of John was true when I think it's Gospel of John, where Peter runs to the tomb, but John's faster and gets there first. He said,
yeah,
that doesn't sound like something anybody would make up. Like, that's just like reporting it. Like, who would make up a weird, odd detail like that?
Correct. It doesn't fit with the fabricating theory.
Yeah, right. Okay, so what else? There's embarrassing details all throughout the Gospels. So what else suggests to us that it's not deception?
Well, the gospel writers actually omit material that we'd expect to find if they were intentionally inventing the Jesus story. So consider the fact that in the early church, there were a lot of controversies that arose, right? And what we do not find in the gospels or the gospel writers putting into the mouth of Jesus the resolutions
to those controversies.
Oh,
consider,
for example, the circumcision controversy.
Right.
Luke tells us in Book of Acts, chapter 15, there was this huge debate about whether Gentiles needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. And he tells us it was no small dissension. Luke says, he says in verse 2 of Acts chapter 15, it was no small dissension, and there was much debate, so much so that Paul and Barnabas couldn't settle the issue, so they had to take it up to Jerusalem for the apostles and the presbyters to consider the matter, and you have the Council of Jerusalem.
Right.
Well, if the gospel writers were making up the story
just
of
slip
Jesus...
Just slip a line in there,
right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, like, for example, John... when he records in John 3:16, Jesus saying, whoever shall believe in the Son of Man shall have eternal life, right?
Yeah.
If John was making this stuff up, he could have easily just said, whoever believes and is not circumcised shall have eternal life, right? But that's not what we find. And so that the gospel writers omit such material like that indicates to us that they are not inventing these sayings of Jesus, but that they are intending to preserve what they think is the authentic tradition of Jesus. And you could also think about the controversies that Paul had to deal with, right? So recall in his first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 14, he's dealing with tongues, the issue of tongues, speaking in tongues and prophecy, instructing the Corinthians, pursue the gift of prophecy over tongues because that's the better gift. And with regard to tongues, if you're speaking in tongues in the church and there's no one to interpret, keep silent, right? Or concerning women speaking during the liturgical assembly in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. He gives the instruction to the women to hold your questions for when you get home and ask your husbands at home, because apparently there was an issue in the Corinth church of women speaking up in the liturgical assembly and asking all these questions. And so Paul's giving instruction, keep silent, hold your questions for when you get home and ask them to your husband. Now, if the gospel writers were making up the Jesus story and inventing the sayings of Jesus, it would have been really easy for them to slip in these instructions of Paul and put them in the mouth of Jesus to justify Paul's instructions. So, for example, in Matthew 18, remember the unruly believer who's sinning? You try to go and convince him, take two or three witnesses, and then you take him to the church, right? The gospel writers could have easily, you know, put into the words of Jesus, oh, yeah, and when women act unruly in church, and when Christians act unruly in the liturgical assembly and speaking in tongues, you, the church, make a judgment. Take him to the church, and if he doesn't listen to the church, treat him as a Gentile or tax collector. The church can tell him to be silent. You don't find that in the Gospels.
No.
And so that's a strong indication that the Gospel writers were not inventing the sayings of Jesus, but trying to preserve what they perceive to be authentic traditions.
Okay, so they include stuff that's embarrassing. They omit stuff that would have been really helpful. If we were making this up, you would have just slipped that in there, would have solved all the problems.
Yep.
You would have had no trouble. Any other things that...
Well, there's actually a related point here, and that is to say that Paul himself gives us explicit evidence that he did not alter the apostolic tradition to fit some sort of agenda of his. And that actually sets a precedent for the gospel writers who are writing after Paul. So in 1 Corinthians 7, remember, Cy, how Paul, in verses 10 through 11, says, to the married I give charge, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, and if that the husband should not divorce his wife. So when he's given instructions about divorce and remarriage, if you divorce, you remain separated or you reconcile, no remarriage. He's saying it's not my teaching, it's the Lord's teaching.
Right. Yeah.
But right after that, in verse 12, he says, to the rest, I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. So notice how Paul distinguishes between his teaching and Jesus' teaching.
Yeah.
He's not interested in putting into the mouth of Jesus his own opinions.
Very careful, as a matter of fact.
And that sets a precedent for the gospel writers who would be following him, and then they would follow suit in preserving that authentic tradition.
We're talking about the story of Jesus, truth or fiction? Is it real or is it a myth? Well, Carl is explaining why we can trust that it's a true story. More after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Christianity depends on history being true. It's not just a philosophical religion. It's not just a religion where we make certain claims about, that how you can overcome suffering or what charity is. It depends on a story of a person, Jesus, and the fact that he walked upon this earth, did certain things, said certain things. All of this is at the root of it. And if those things are not true, our faith is not true. And if our faith is not true, it's kind of pointless to hold on to it. We might take this or that from it, like we take from any tradition. But why adhere to it? Why be Christians if the story itself is not true? So that's what we're here to talk about with Carlo Broussard. Carlo's an apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And here, obstacles to the church, right?
To Jesus, the gospel, to Christianity.
But I, for a second, I just panicked that I said the subtitle of the book wrong, because I always get the subtitles wrong. But I got that one right?
You got it. Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. The gospel is sort of the blanket.
Yeah,
the umbrella for Jesus and Christianity.
Yeah, right. So is that story true? And you've been giving us evidence that it is. And the two main objections that you gave us are dishonesty. They made this story up. The early Christians made the story up. The other one is, no, they're not dishonest, but they got the story wrong for whatever reason. So I want to wrap up the dishonest.
Yeah.
You've addressed a whole bunch of it. But is there any other reason to kind of be convinced, to be confident that this is not just a made-up story?
Yeah, I think one last response we could give is that the gospel writers are writing at a time when eyewitnesses are present to ensure faithful records. Now, granted, this is presupposing the reasonableness of the argument that they're writing around, the gospel writers are writing around AD 60. Mm-hmm. Mark's probably writing a little bit before that. So Luke's gospel around AD 60, Matthew right around before that, Mark even before that. So it's presupposing that argument, but we could talk about this in a few moments. But given the fact that the gospel writers are writing within and right at 30 to 35 years removed from the actual events that they were recording.
Right.
There are eyewitnesses still present at the time when they're pinning these events and putting it onto quote unquote paper.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
But the gospel writers themselves affirm and ensure the reader that eyewitnesses were present when they're writing these gospels and that they consulted eyewitnesses. So for example, Luke, in Luke chapter 1, verse 2, in his prologue, he says, "The things delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word." And he talks about how he consulted many eyewitnesses in order to construct this narrative that we call the Gospel of Luke. John, in his first letter, 1 John 1:1, he says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes." So that particular author of John, of the first letter of John, is saying that, hey, I'm an eyewitness. And of course, the author of the Gospel of John would suggest the same thing
right,
in his
exactly.
Gospel. St. Paul, when he's talking about those who have seen the resurrected Lord in 1 Corinthians 15:6, he says, Jesus appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom were still alive.
Yeah.
And Paul's writing his letter to the Corinthians right at the beginning of the 50s, right, AD 51 or 52, and he's saying eyewitnesses are still present when he's penning that letter
yeah.
and offering the challenge, like, hey, if you don't believe me, go talk to yeah. the eyewitnesses, right? And those eyewitnesses would have still been present when Matthew, Mark, and Luke are writing their gospels anywhere from AD 55 to AD 60, AD 65 within that time frame. And so consider this, Si, if we compare, like, let's just take the dating of Luke's gospel. And one argument why we know Luke probably wrote around AD 60 is because in his book of Acts, he records Paul's house arrest, which scholars date to about AD 62. And given the abrupt ending of Luke's book of Acts, he doesn't tell us how Paul died. He doesn't record Paul's martyrdom. He recorded Deacon Stephen's martyrdom. He recorded the martyrdom of James the Greater,
right.
But he doesn't record Paul's martyrdom.
Half the book is about Paul.
That's right. He leads all the way up to Paul, to the house arrest, but then, boop, he's done, right?
Yeah.
And so that suggests that Luke was writing at the time Paul was under house arrest and then finished the book of Acts before his death. And so because his house arrest was about AD 62, that tells us the book of Acts was probably written right around there, no later than that, probably about AD 60. And since he wrote his gospel before the book of Acts, that would put his gospel AD 60 or before. We know scholars tell us Mark wrote before Luke. And so that puts Mark within 30 years of the events that they're recording. Now, compare that to our vets who, say, fought in Vietnam. Right.
Yes.
Vietnam ended in 1975. So that's, we're currently 46 years removed from those events.
Right.
And many of those vets can tell you stories of what they went through.
Oh, yeah.
In fighting for us. Right. And
it's
fighting.
It's funny because my dad's a Vietnam vet.
Yeah.
And not only could he tell you the stories, but I could tell you those stories because I've heard them from him. So that's funny. Yeah. That's a great way to think about
it.
Yeah. Putting it in contemporary terms like
and
that.
And 46 years removed from the event. That's more than what these gospel writers, more of a time gap than what these gospel writers are working with, because they're writing within 30 years or right at 30 years removed. So if our Vietnam vets can remember the stories and the events of what happened when they were there,
right.
Well, then these eyewitnesses and those who are talking to eyewitnesses would know about those events, right? So the eyewitness accounts were present at the time the gospel writers are writing to ensure faithful transmission. You said your dad, this was your father?
Right.
If you go around fabricating events about what happened in Vietnam, your dad would shut you down, right?
Exactly.
And say, no, that's not how it happened.
Right.
So too with the gospel writers, with having the eyewitnesses present, they would be shutting down any sort of fabricated sayings and events and deeds of Jesus. And so that is a strong reason to believe that these gospel writers were not just making this stuff up and inventing the sayings of Jesus.
All right, so let's say I become convinced they didn't make this up. But then my next objection then is, well, they could have gotten the story wrong. I mean, it could be an honest attempt to tell the story, but just not true because they
just
didn't
mistaken,
get it right.
Yeah, right. They were mistaken. Or maybe the traditions that they're drawing from had legendary developments.
Yeah, right.
And so in response to this, I think, Cy, there's a great acronym that I got from the biblical scholar Craig Blomberg, AID. AID.
Yes.
They were able to write reliable history. They intended to write reliable history, and they did write reliable history.
Right.
And so that they were able, there are several reasons to think this, one of which we've already talked about, namely that the gospel writers were either eyewitnesses themselves or close associates with eyewitnesses. And having eyewitness testimony is like gold, not just for us, I mean, not just for ancients, right, and ancient sources, but even for us to have an eyewitness account is a strong, reliable source for the events that are being recorded. And we know Mark from tradition was a disciple of Peter. Luke was a companion of Paul who had, you know, access to Peter and the apostles and eyewitnesses. So those are associates of eyewitnesses. Matthew and John, they were eyewitnesses themselves. So we have eyewitness testimony and close associates of eyewitnesses who are recording for us these events of Jesus. So that in and of itself tells us they would have been in a proper position
to
reliably transmit the information concerning Jesus. Secondly, the Gospels, getting back to what we were talking about a while ago, were written within close temporal proximity, within living memory of the events they're recording. Already articulated the line of reasoning that we would take in order to show when they were written. Acts of the Apostles, probably about AD 62, the Gospel of Luke coming before that, AD 60, Mark even before that. So we're within and right at 30 years removed from the events they're recording, right?
Yes.
Now, compare that, Cy, to say the biographies of Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
And or Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, which are over 400 years removed.
Right.
And nobody questions the historical reliability of those biographies.
No.
So what do you think is more reliable, a 400-year time gap or a 35-year time gap?
Exactly, right.
We're going to go with the 35-year time gap, right? Or consider the six sources for the life of Caesar Augustus. They range from 90 to 200 years removed from the events that they record. Even John's gospel, which is 60 years removed from the events he's recording, still
is
reigns supreme,
right?
Compared to the sources of the life of Caesar Augustus. So whenever we compare the temporal proximity of the gospels to the events that they're recording, we see that we're able to conclude reasonably that they are indeed able to accurately convey that which Jesus said and did, because it's within living memory.
Carlo, I have to take a break.
Okay.
So we'll come back with more on the story of Jesus, fact or fiction, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I told him about the woman who came to me and said her two children hadn't spoken to each other for 2 years. Their grandma died and she was very wealthy. She left half to each one. She said they're arguing over a commode. She said it's inlaid. Can you imagine being in hell and somebody saying to you, what are you here for?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Carlo Broussard, and this hour we're talking about the Jesus story. Is it a fact or is it fiction? And of course, in all honesty, Carlo and I are both people who take it to be fact and believe in it. And that makes it possible for us to make Jesus the center of our lives. Without that confidence that we're dealing with real history, how can you have confidence in Jesus? I mean, I'm sure that there are people who do for other reasons, but we really desire that confidence. All right, so Carlo, you're saying they weren't being deceptive, and you gave us a lot of evidence about that. Well, first you gave us a lot of evidence that the manuscripts themselves, we have great evidence that these are reliable manuscripts.
And
very
what's
early.
In the manuscripts, yeah, is what was in the autographs.
Yeah, okay, and then the people who wrote those autographs, the autograph being the original copy of, say, Mark's gospel.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for that clarification.
The people who wrote those, you made a very strong argument, were not trying to be deceptive. They weren't liars, and there's good reason to, and not just taking their word for it. There's good rational reasons to accept that they were not liars. Okay, but did they get the story wrong? And you're saying, well, it was within living memory. There were these other witnesses that could have contradicted them and all of that. But what about the person who says, look, okay, even your best, you know, you date Mark to the earliest. Mark is the first gospel. Date at the earliest it is. We got 30 years passing.
Right.
Can you really remember what Jesus said about the Our Father after 30 years? Can you really get these details right?
Well, that's a good question because I can't remember what I had for lunch 2 weeks ago.
Right. Yeah.
I can remember what I had for breakfast 2 weeks ago because I eat the same breakfast every single morning.
Okay, that's interesting.
I once had a teenager. I was giving a talk on Jesus to some high schoolers, and I brought up this point. Like, do you remember what you ate for breakfast 2 weeks ago? She was like, yeah, because I eat the same thing every morning.
I was like, okay,
I got to go to lunch now.
But that's related to the answer about why they could remember something like the Our Father.
That's a very good point. I never actually noticed that. Yeah. And so the point is because I eat the same thing every single morning, I know what I ate for breakfast 2 weeks ago. So if we could apply that to the apostles, consider this, Cy.
Right.
The apostles didn't just receive a lecture, some flyby lecture in a lecture hall. You know, we go listen to a talk and we're like, we walk out the door and we go home and, you know, Missy says, so what did Carlo talk about, Cy?
And you're like,
I don't know.
Talk about Jesus again. I don't know, Missy.
But that's not the case for the apostles. They lived with Jesus for 3 years. They were with him 24/7. And you can bet that it wasn't just Jesus gave a talk, gave a teaching, and then that was it. No, they were asking him about it. They were talking to him about it. And Jesus would have gave teachings multiple times in multiple different situations. So you have the apostles being students of Jesus, and so that would lend itself for the teachings of Jesus assimilating within their own heart and within their own mind to be able to remember the substance of what Jesus is teaching. And of course, Jesus would have given those teachings in a variety of different ways. The apostles would have frequently rehearsed Jesus's teachings when he sends them out to go and preach, right?
Oh, this is a way of teaching too, because in order to share it, you've got to really internalize
it. You got to know it. That's right. And then they're living in a cultural milieu that valued memory skills, memorization, because that was one of the primary ways in which information was transmitted. So memory skills were way more developed for their culture than it is for ours. Everything's right here on our computer, right? We don't have to memorize much of this stuff.
No.
So given the fact that they're naturally predisposed to good memory skills, they would have been able to remember what Jesus said and did. And furthermore, Si, the gospel writers actually have sources, oral sources, that predate the actual pinning of the events, right? When they're actually writing the text, they have sources they're drawing from that predate their gospels.
Right.
And so
they
that,
even tell us that. Like Luke, particularly, you already talked about Luke.
I've interviewed eyewitnesses. And Paul will say, I deliver to you what I have received, like the words of institution in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 22 through 23.
They had to tell them that.
The words of institution is a part of a tradition that predates the actual pinning of the letter to the Corinthians about AD 52. So the words of institution, it's coming from a source before that, putting it closer in temporal proximity to the words of Jesus.
Right.
So that lessens the time gap, which in turn excludes the possibility of legendary developments.
Yeah.
So you have that factor. Scholars often point out how it's likely they would have had written notes, especially Matthew. He would have been able to write. He was a tax collector.
Sure.
It's very reasonable that he would have had shorthand notes as listening to the rabbi Jesus teach. And of course, there was leadership to ensure faithful transmission. There were eyewitnesses to ensure faithful transmission. So when you take all of this into account,
right,
we have good, solid reason to think that these gospel writers would have been able to remember what Jesus said and did. And it's not like they're just like forgetting and then messing things up and developing these things in sort of a legendary way.
No, and it's not like, can you remember what happened on this day 30 years ago? It's not that kind of thing. It's more like, I mean, I don't know, how long has it been since I've been in college? It's probably coming up on 40 years. But I can remember the things I learned in college. I mean, part of getting the theology degree was there's a certain amount of repetition. You memorize. Yeah. So, and Jesus is the greatest teacher ever. So he knows all the techniques to help you with it.
That's right.
And then it's not just an individual trying to remember. It's a living community that's trying to remember.
That's ensuring the faithful transmission of the information. That's a great point, because it's not just a single individual. It's the whole family, right?
Yeah.
That's transmitting the information.
Yeah. Okay. So
those are reasons to think that they were able to write reliable history.
Okay.
But then somebody could say, okay, well, maybe they were able, but did they intend to write reliable history? Maybe they were in a position to write reliable history, but they just simply didn't intend to do so, and they were intending to write some sort of mythological story or a mythical story about Jesus. And of course, this would tie into what we talked about already, that they would simply be inventing the sayings of Jesus. So this aspect is related, but we can go further and give reasons why the gospel writers intended to write reliable history. They record details that are not of the legendary genre. So in the gospels, they give us details that are subject to historical verification. They're talking about historical events, Passover, Festival of Tabernacles, etc. They're talking about historical individuals of high status that people of the time could have verified, right? Yeah. And say, wow, this is an individual of a pretty high status, and this dude never existed, right?
Yeah.
But they record like Pontius Pilate, Joseph Caiaphas, John the Baptist, Caesar Augustus, Herod, Felix, Archelaus, Agrippa, Gallio, Caiaphas, Ananias, right? Nicodemus.
All people who are in the historical record outside of
that's
the scriptures.
That's right. Legendary stories do not include such details or figures that would be subject to historical verification. That these gospel writers include such figures as this tells us they were intending to write reliable history. And then historical time periods, right? The 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, according to Luke, in Luke chapter 3, verse 1.
Right.
He's rooting these events at a specific point in history, making it thus subject to historical verification. And of course, the gospel writers express their intention. And we already mentioned Luke and his prologue. John expresses his intention, John 19:35. He who saw it has borne witness, his testimony is true, and he knows that he tells the truth, that you also may believe.
Right.
So these gospel writers explicitly express their intention to write reliable history. Now, somebody might come back and say, well, they're trying to deceive us. They're lying about it. But that gets back to what we already said. We gave reasons to think that they're not fabricating and being deceptive and conspiring to lie about these events. So not only were they able to write reliable history, but they actually intended to do so.
And so the conclusion is that they did? Then
that's the last aspect of the last strategy we could employ, is that they did write reliable history. And there are a variety of ways in which we can show this, but one way is we can use the criteria that I mentioned earlier that historians use in order to discern if specific sayings or events are historically reliable. And the more of the criteria that are marked off, the more probable and historically reliable it is. The more probable its historical reliability is. So let's just take, for example, the criterion of multiple attestation. Like the more independent sources that you have,
yes, okay,
the more reliable this event is, the more likely this event is historical is.
Right. Okay? If everybody says from a different angle, hey, right, I saw it.
So, for example, take the death of Jesus by crucifixion. You have the four Gospels, you have Paul's epistles, you have the writings of the early church fathers, you have first century Jewish historian Josephus, you have the Roman historian Tacitus, all independently affirming the historical existence of Jesus,
yes,
but also his death by crucifixion. So given this multiple attestation of Jesus' death by crucifixion, that gives historians good reason to conclude that Jesus died by crucifixion is historically reliable. The probability of its historicity shoots up drastically,
right?
Because of the multiple independent sources. You also have the criterion of coherence. Right. So whenever you have some event that's being talked about and it coheres with other known facts, it's more likely it's historical.
Yeah.
And it's a fact. So take, once again, Jesus' death by crucifixion. That coheres with the other facts that we know historically about Jesus, namely these claims to be divine.
Yeah.
And
right,
given the first century culture of Judaism, when you claim to be divine, it's going to merit some negative consequences like death,
right?
Blasphemy was subject to the penalty of death. And so that's why they put Jesus to death. So death by crucifixion coheres with these claims to be divine. So that gives us reason to think that death by crucifixion is reasonably a historical fact concerning Jesus Christ. And then, of course, we could look at the resurrection of Jesus. You know, many scholars point to the fact that the gospel writers make the women the first witnesses of the resurrection of Jesus,
right,
of the resurrected Jesus, I should
right
say, and the appearance of Jesus. Well, that meets the criterion of embarrassment,
right,
getting back to those embarrassing details, because in first century Judaism, the testimony of a woman was not held in high esteem. But yet these gospel writers are rooting the resurrected Jesus in women as the first witnesses of
yeah
Jesus. And so if they're making this stuff up, they would not be making the women the first witnesses. So the embarrassment criterion tells us that these women saw Jesus, that they're reporting that they saw something. We could inquire about the nature of it, but they had some experience, tells us that these gospel writers are simply recording it as it has been handed down to them, and they're not making it up. And so it tells us that they did record accurate history. These women of the first century saw something, and they say it was Jesus. And then, of course, we put all the other evidence in the bag, and we come to the conclusion that, you know, what they saw was not a hallucination, it was not a vision, but it was what they said it was, the resurrected Jesus in the flesh.
So the writers of the Gospels, the other writers of the New Testament, particularly St. Paul, because he wrote
yeah
so much, but Peter in his letters, able to tell real history about Jesus, intended to tell real history about Jesus, and did in fact tell the real history.
Yeah, and those details, many of those details are affirmed or confirmed by extra biblical sources, getting back to Josephus and Tacitus.
Yes.
Some details of the Gospels are confirmed in non-Christian sources, and that's even more evidence that they did write reliable history.
Carlo Broussard has been our guest. Carlo, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, Si.
You can find all of Carlo's books over at shop.catholic.com, including his latest, Purgatory is for Real. Good news about the afterlife for those who aren't perfect yet. Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.